Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening and welcome to
Ferment About It
on heritageradionetwork.org.
Your weekly journey through all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on heritageradionetwork.org. My name is Chris Kuzmi.
I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And our beloved Mary Izette is home today, closing out the summer with responsible stuff. It's during the day. This is a pre-record. Mary and I are fresh back from the Honey Beer Summit. We were flown by the National Honey Board to go to St. Louis and talk all things fermenting beer with honey, and it was just absolutely incredible. St. Louis is a really great city. We went to Perennial, Side Project, Urban Chestnut, and had a few days of seminars. Just got our learn on and met a lot of really amazing brewers from around the country. We look forward to hosting the National Honey Board on November 13th live here in the studio. They'll be in town for some other things, and we're excited about that.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
It's the end of August right now. This will air sometime in September. No, wait, September 1st, right? No, it's the
today
end of August.
Today is August 31st.
It's still August.
Yep, August lasts forever.
All right, fine.
Summer right. Does not.
That's today, but the today that you're listening to this at, it has nothing to do with that. And
it's still technically summer, though.
Fair enough. I'm excited about the end of summer beers, and a lot has gone on with the brewery, and I can't wait to find out what I'm actually doing when this actually airs. But today, we finally worked out some grain removal, spent grain stuff. We are so close to beginning Fifth Hammer, and I can't be more excited, and I can't wait to shout it out when there's more to tell. But today, we are welcoming some people we've been wanting to have on the show for quite some time since their first book. They're fresh here in New York City from the Boston Fermentation Festival, visiting the East Coast from Oregon, right?
Yeah.
And we have Christopher and Kirsten Chalky. Hello. Thanks. Welcome
Hello.
To the
Hello.
Show.
Yeah, we're excited to be here.
How long has your trip been so far? Like, when did you get to Boston? Or did you go straight to Boston from
we
Oregon?
We did. We went straight to Boston. We had 4 days there. Then we took the train to New York on Monday.
Fantastic.
And so we've been here for 4 days.
We really don't want to go home.
We end up at the Sonoma Fermentation Festival on Saturday. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
A lot of moving.
Yeah. A lot of fermentation festivals.
A lot of fermentation festivals. So let's go right into fermentation. We like fermentation. That's what the show is about. And this is we're currently on your second book tour, or promoting your second book, correct?
Yes.
The first book was called Fermented Vegetables. And how long have you been fermenting? What got you into all this thing? Who are you? Why are we listening to you guys? Why should we take it from you?
I don't know. So we've been fermenting since about 1999. It came from a Christmas present from my mom. She put a bubbling crock, like an antique crock, full of sauerkraut bubbling under the Christmas tree.
Under the Christmas tree.
Under the Christmas tree, yeah.
Nothing and like the fresh smell of pine and fermenting sauerkraut.
Sauerkraut, right? It was concerning to the kids as well.
Yeah. I bet it kept the cat away from eating the...
Yeah, everybody, really.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
So for years, that's what we did. We fermented sauerkraut, and we live on a homestead in Southern Oregon and have lots of friends that are organic farmers. And... about 2009, so we did a lot of fermenting because I made cheese, Christopher makes hard cider. We put in a commercial kitchen. We wanted to do a cidery.
Very cool.
And while we were waiting for the grafted apples to grow, I said, hey, let's ferment vegetables. It's quick. It's easy. You know, unlike cheese, nobody's going to ever get hurt. The laws around it in Oregon are super easy. So we started fermenting commercially in about 2010. Did that for a few years and... two things happened. One was it was super exciting to just work with the farmers seasonally. Like, what, you know, I'd get a call. I have 400 pounds of burdock. Can you ferment it? And they'd be like, I don't know. And at the time, you'd look on the internet, and there was nothing about fermenting most vegetables. And so usually my thought was, well, it doesn't say it'll kill me. So let's go for it. And so we had all these seasonal recipes that just came from what was in season, either on our farm or on other farms. And the flavor development was just super exciting. But at the same time, people were discovering it. And we realized at the market booth, we did so much education.
That's cool.
And people really wanted to understand it. So that first book sort of came out of all of that teaching at the booth, teaching then on our farm, thinking about CSAs, you know, A to Z. People get way too many turnips and they're like, what do I do? So that was sort of... the beginning of, and then we decided teaching and writing, and all of that was a lot lighter work than heavy crocks. So we sort of switched gears.
How big is the farm, and what are you growing on the farm?
40 acres up in the mountains, so it's hillside. Kirsten won't let me have a tractor because there's too many hillsides to roll over. So we have all those cider apples and a lot of heritage stuff going on. And then our son is also... does restoration work, so we've got a lot of baby trees on the property as well.
Oh, wow.
So, and Kirsten's always trying to smuggle beavers onto the property, but it's got you have to actually smuggle them in Oregon. They're illegal.
That's my favorite joke right now. What'd the fish say when it ran into a wall? Damn.
Nice. Yeah. Love it.
I'll be here every Monday for until they fire me. So the cidery, tell me a little about that. Is it, you guys are commercially making cider?
No, just for friends and family.
Okay.
About 140 gallons just for personal use.
Very cool.
You know, our little foray into production made us decide that production's cool, but it's a lot of work.
Sure. Yeah.
Kind of seeing a theme here.
And then we decided, wow, you know, our commercial kitchen's a really good teaching space. You know, making cider for ourselves is really fun. And
we teach people too. We tag it onto the fermentation. So we'll do a couple days of vegetables and then you cheese or cider. Mm-hmm.
When did the first book come out, Fermented Vegetables?
October 2014.
Yeah.
2014.
Yeah.
Did you go straight into this next chapter of proverbial chapter of life, many chapters of it being fiery ferments.
It's quite long, yeah.
A lot of chapters in fiery ferments.
Not really. So fiery came about because of really cannabis. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Of course.
Okay.
Cannabis, cannabis grow across the next farm over. They're pulling out, so they said, and they had this beautiful organic soil. And they said, we got to be out tomorrow. You can grab all the soil you want for $100. And so we fired up the Dodges, and we spent 14 hours shoveling soil and pulling it off that farm before they changed owners. And so we were growing peppers, and Kirsten sent me to the Grange to get some peppers, and I got way too many. And the combination of this souped-up cannabis dirt and those too many peppers, we had, like, peppers that were 4 or 5 feet tall.
Wow.
They were so happy.
That's pretty awesome.
You're talking about the plant, not the peppers, right?
Right. Exactly. But a four-foot-tall pepper plant puts out a lot of peppers.
Yeah, really nice peppers.
Yeah, so you had all these peppers, had to do something with them.
Yeah. We've been throwing around a couple of ideas, you know, about what is next, what does the next book look like. And we started we always ferment a lot of peppers every year because we love a simple pepper mash because there's so much you can do with it. But then when we had so many peppers, it's like, how much pepper mash can you really use? So that's when we started exploring a couple of things. One is just all kinds of condiments and really pushing that condiment thing. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of the most exciting part for me of this book was taking it from really this idea of fermented salads or krauts and moving into the condiment world. So what happened was we started doing the research, like how did humans get their heat before pepper? And that was a lot of fun to think about, okay, so the chili actually didn't hit the scene in Asia or some of the places we think of that have super hot foods until Columbus made his little mistake and, mm-hmm. you know, ran into South America.
Yeah, actually, can you talk a little bit more about your research process in this book? Because there's a lot of information about like the history of fermentation and the history of all these various spices from all over the world. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you want to talk about it or do you want me
to? So research kind of goes, I'll dig up something that sounds super cool. And then we have no idea how they did it. And so then now the kitchen's really like a lab for us. So then Kirsten goes into the kitchen and tries to figure out what did that taste like in 1450. And so long peppers and some of those things, galangal root, these recipes we would find, you had no idea really, but we figured they were fermented, but there was no recipe about how to do that. So we had to kind of reinvent what that likely tasted like.
Well, and even if they weren't maybe fermented, but eaten fresh, adding that layer of fermentation adds mm-hmm. just such an interesting layer of flavor and complexity. So that was a lot of fun. It was just taking these old recipes, whether they were fermented or not. And in some cases, it was just medieval spice blends or things like that and seeing what would happen when we layered on that fermentation.
Where did you find these old recipes and
come
about these?
Yeah, just all over the place. Just wherever, you know, obviously the internet is
yeah.
University libraries.
University libraries is a good place.
Yeah.
Just
hit the stacks. We hit the stacks.
And then another thing that we really were playing around with in this book was the Himalayan ferments, the achars, because they're really unique.
I was going to ask what is achar?
Ask about that.
Yeah. it's the fermenting tradition, the pickle tradition that comes from, you know, the high mountains in the Himalayas, Nepal. Those areas of India, they have these pickles. And like we have a pickled daikon recipe in there that is just amazing because what happens is what they did or still do traditionally is they actually dehydrate these pepper or these ingredients first a little bit, like till they're leathery.
Okay.
So whereas when we're making sauerkraut here and most ferments, it's all about getting as much water and brine as possible, right? So you can really sink it. So with these achars, what originally kind of brought me to them is they're really heavy in Sichuan pepper, which is one of the pre and ginger. And these are some of the pre-heat things that Asia had before that chili pepper came onto the scene. And so there's the that and mustard seed and mustard oil. And so they're using sort of the antifungal properties of the mustard seed and the mustard oil, and some of them have sesame seed in them, so it's a drier ferment. And then they stuck them out in the sun to use the warmth to
keep
get the lactobacillus going and kill off the other things. So it's a neat tradition, and it's pretty unique to that area.
And with it being drier, did that keep it from going too acetic generally, or
it doesn't get as acetic, but it still has this wonderful pickly flavor. The cucumber one still it's like there's a little pickle because you chop it up into diced pieces. It's like there's a little pickle buried in this really unique kind of prickly flavor because the Sichuan pepper gives you such that prickle.
So just to be clear, it's achar, the process or what you call that group of pickles made in this way, or they're kind of together?
It's what the Indian pickles are called now. Okay. So I think it means pickle or the process. But yeah, in this Himalayan tradition, That's what I call the process that we use. I don't know if that's completely correct.
Rachel has been stalking you guys and says you guys have lived a lot of different places. Is that true? She's doing due diligence.
Also, you talk in the book a lot about visiting different places as a child. So how has that contributed to any of the recipes that you have in your book?
My father's an anthropologist, so we did move all over the place.
That's awesome. That's
fun. Indonesia. We were on an island in the Spice Islands. I think, though, for me, it's just a willingness to try things. And, you know, I just love mixing it up with cuisine and taking things I've had and putting them together and see what happens. And sometimes it works really well and sometimes not so much.
But you can change. So I grew up in the Midwest in Missouri. And when I met Kirsten, I ate three vegetables. And one of them only if it was covered in blue cheese dressing. So, you know, we meet people all the time that, like, sauerkraut's the first thing they've had, and now they're opening up to this. So, you know, my life changed pretty dramatically. I used to have a great sweet tooth. I love my sweet tooth. I was so proud of my sweet tooth. And then as you eat more fermented vegetables, I lost it. Now I crave this.
We're going to take a really quick break and come back to you on Ferment About It.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
Welcome back to Ferment About It. We are here in studio with Kirsten Shockey and her husband, Christopher Shockey. Episode 214, talking about the new book, Fiery Ferments. You were on a book tour. How did you accidentally find out that fruit ferments wonderfully?
That what ferments wonderfully?
Fruit.
Oh, fruit.
The lore goes of Kirsten Shockey that accidentally found out that fruit ferments wonderfully. Fruit what was this happy accident that Rachel speaks
it,
of?
Yeah.
I know that I think dried fruit ferments wonderfully. And maybe that's what we're thinking about here. So the dried fruit is amazing because if you want a sweetness, if you want to bring those sugars into your ferment and you don't want the lactobacillus to acidify them, you put the dried fruit in and for some reason it holds that sweetness. So when you're wanting, you know, that chutney flavor, raisins or pineapple,
yeah,
dried pineapple, not the sugary kind. You have to get the, you know, the real just dried stuff, but it
will, the dried pineapple.
It makes a wonderful flavor.
Where are your favorite sources for such things?
You know, we're really lucky in Southern Oregon. We have just a couple of wonderful co-ops, so I just go to the bulk bins and find the dried fruits.
Are there any favorite combos of types of peppers and types of fruits that you have that you really dig? Like as a brewer, we often have habanero, mango, and pineapple infusions with IPAs that are already kind of there's a dance that happens quite lovely.
Yeah, that was one. There's a vanilla habanero in there, and then Kirsten would do a pineapple reduction, add that to that, and then put that over a really good vanilla ice cream. Oh my God. You get the ice cream and the hot. You get the, dopamine.
Pineapple, it works super well. I mean, there's just even a plain pepper mash with a little pineapple in it is surprisingly good. So sounds like the same.
What does it mean to be a fermented hot sauce? What's the minimum time of fermentation? What is the process of making a fermented hot sauce or a fiery ferment? Just basic.
You can go area. You can go there two ways. You can either dry brine it, so you're making it like a sauerkraut. You're chopping up the peppers and then add in the salt and just like you would a sauerkraut, basically, and keep all that below the brine line. And then, depending later, if you're going to do it to a sauce, then you're just going to blend it up and strain it out and do it that way. Or you could start out brining your peppers first. And then taking it from there.
Like
and,
a pickling, yep. Sinking like a the whole peppers in with the brine, which works really nicely with dried chipotle peppers, as you can you can put them in a little jar, you know, leave a little space for expansion, but put that salt brine in there with some garlic and just, you know, forget about it for a few weeks and then blend all that up and you just have this wonderful smoky, sour hot sauce.
Yeah. And you do that at ambient temperature, right?
Mm-hmm. Room temperature, 72. Yeah, room temperature. The unique thing about hot sauce or peppers, and I don't know quite the science. I've been told it's the alkaloids, but you know, a sauerkraut, if you were to leave it out beyond 2-3 months, all those carbs will have been consumed by the lactobacillus, and it just starts getting a flat, sour, and dull, and then it just doesn't seem lively anymore. But the hot sauces, they can go a couple of years and they still will layer on more and more interesting flavors. And a lot of people know this, but some people don't. But Tabasco sauce starts out as a fermented pepper mash in oak barrels, and they ferment it for 2 to 3 years, I've heard.
Wow.
So, yeah, peppers are unique that way. But it's done as soon as it's acidic.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, there's a lot of different kinds of hot peppers on various ranks of the Scoville scale. Are there any that you guys have found in, like, making this book or in your own cooking experiences that, like, have the most range of flavor combinations or just make the most interesting things?
Yeah, what do you think?
You know, I love habaneros. I know they're super hot, but I like to dial them up or down. You can put if you can do straight habanero mash, but if you only want a little bit of that flavor, then you can put it with a bell pepper, like a yellow bell pepper, and you can mix it up. What I like about them is they've got this great sweetness, and they also, the burn comes on a little bit delayed, so you think you've got this, and then it starts building.
I think I'm fine. Pile this on.
And then, I mean, it's, you know, jalapenos, they just always work. So it's those basic peppers. But then I think for a mash,
Fresnos are nice.
The Fresnos are our favorite.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with Fresnos.
They're kind of in the same heat range as a jalapeno, but they're a beautiful bright red. They've got a little more sweetness. We see them this time of year, so August, September, at the markets, but the rest of the year, they're not really around, so they're not real popular yet, I guess.
We start out making a gallon jar, or actually 2 gallon jars, and then as we eat down, you know, then it becomes the 2-quart and then the 1-quart, and about the bad time is about May when I'm down to like a pint or half pint. I'm just waiting.
What is the shelf life on a fermented hot sauce?
So in the refrigerator, we have actually some that we have since about 2010, and we just are leaving it there and seeing what happens. And right now it's still perfectly fine. So the refrigerated shelf life is really long. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't think I've had a hot sauce go yet since I've been doing this. But if you want to make it more shelf stable and get that fermentation to stop, what you can do is that's when you can add a little bit of a nice vinegar. And we talk a little bit about blending in the book. So you've got your pepper mash, and if you want to make Christmas presents or something, then you can add that little bit of vinegar, and then it won't be as bubbly if you take it out of the refrigerator. Sure.
Mm-hmm. And you might get the pH down to just a more stable.
A little bit more,
slowing everything down.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to, you know, from your first book to this book, and talk, you have vast experience in fermenting vegetables of all kinds. Is there a difference, or is it easier or harder or different or the same to go the pepper route? And if so, or if anything, for what reason?
I think for the dry mat, the the dry. It's just there are smaller pieces and they want to float to the top. So there's a little more management to it. You know, you don't have a larger pieces like a kimchi that's going to kind of knit together. So you got the pieces that are always trying. You're constantly facing the everything wants to float to the top.
Right.
But we give some hints over the years of how to deal with that. So there's a little bit more management, I'd say, on the peppers.
For some of them, yeah.
But not really.
I mean, it's still the process is still just pretty basic, you know? Shred, salt, submerge, you know, keep it under the brine, and you're in good shape. So that part is cool. It's really just as simple. So if you want to eat ferments, but you hate sauerkraut or you never want to eat cabbage, then you can still have them every day.
Go straight to fiery fermented.
Exactly.
Fermentation. Yeah. With your fiery fermentations, do you have any favorite recipes or favorite places?
I'm a little hotter than Kirsten on the scale there, so I like things that are just at the level where I can still taste it, but that I pay for it the next day. It's kind of a weird
thing.
So the vanilla habanero that we talked about, for me, that's one that I can pretty much hit that one a little bit straight, and I love that. I also love the chipotle stuff. Anything that's smoky, I love.
The gochujang.
Gochujang.
Really fun. Yeah. So that it's like the, you know, that thick,
it's the rich chili paste for kimchi. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's good. Really nice. And we've had some that have been fermenting for a couple of years and they just get more and more interesting, and it's, you know, like a catch up with a kick.
That's pretty fun.
Were there any recipes that you were like hesitant on including, or were there any recipes that just didn't quite work out that you wanted to put in, but you couldn't?
I feel like in the world of the achars, you know, that some of the flavors were so unique that I just wasn't sure the American palate was quite ready for some of those flavors.
A little loud,
a little funky. I think that's and then cinnamon. I just kept wanting cinnamon to do something cool, but cinnamon gets, because it is a way that we get heat in our palate. So as far as pre-chili heat, cinnamon would be great, right? But not so much. It gets, you know how when cinnamon gets too wet, it gets sort of, or too much, it gets sort of gelatinous and slimy. And
I did not know that.
Yeah. and I think that's why people can put water in with it and make these little like cookies and things with it just for decoration, because it gets like glue.
But they end like with this...
Yeah.
and I don't know how to put that in words, but on radio it sounds like this.
It got metallic too in the chilies. And the only recipe, there is one cinnamon recipe in there, and it worked with quince, believe it or not.
With quince.
With quince. So the fruit was able to temper that thing, but the chilies, it got metallic and weird and... So, yeah, cinnamon.
Yes, hot cinnamon.
I really wanted more from cinnamon.
You guys are continuing with local education and seminars and classes and along with this book tour, but also in your hometown, right? How do people find out about it?
They can go to ferment.works, our website. And, in fact, a week from this weekend, we're having an intensive. We still have a couple seats left. People come in. We start Friday afternoon. People stay locally, and we'll feed them at least three courses, all ferments, some local ciders and beers and wines, depending on what they want. And then it's, 2 full days in the kitchen, just chopping away, making things. And,
We also have on our website, ferment.works, we have a free e-course, and it's sort of a 7-day little thing with grocery lists, and just make it as easy as possible, because I think that's what we found over the years, is that's what people want to do this so badly, and just that, so we just are trying to find ways to kind of kickstart it for folks, and for some people it's that, for some people you know, it's actually coming and spending time with real people.
And I feel like doing it just enriches one's life, like to feel part of it and to be making things. I mean, certainly.
For sure. And that's actually the most fun to see happening in the classes, is you get people from all over the country and diverse backgrounds, but they totally bond on this particular subject. And by the end, it's like they're a little cohort of fermenting buddies, and I know they keep in touch, not necessarily with us, but
right. Yeah, and you don't have to, I mean, you don't have to do it commercially to enjoy it or to even be, I mean, that's part of, I mean, it's fermentation, it's part of every culture around the world for centuries. And but do you have any students that that you're proud of that have gone commercial kind of thing?
Yeah.
That you know of?
This last class, we had the head chef from Facebook for Raw. She serves like 550 plates a day in the cafeteria.
Wow.
So yeah. She came up to get inspiration, and I think by day two, it looked like her head was going to explode. She had so many ideas, and by day three, she was already kicked in, and we saw some great stuff. She got basically a fermentation station in Facebook's cafeteria.
Nice.
And the last we heard, it's been so popular, they're sending her to Ireland to set up fermentation in Ireland at the Facebook page.
That's fantastic. So. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So
you guys are making lives taste better.
There you go.
Online. Lives online. Yeah.
And offline.
And offline. Tell me about, I want to go back to your ciders, man.
I didn't know about that yet.
So, can we talk about that for a second? Yes, when you said fermenting fruits, like, oh, we're going to have to talk about dry ferment, but I love to ferment real fruit, but I just like to skip to the alcohol side. So we actually have his and her fermentation caves.
Okay.
That we build into the hillside. And and so I do my ciders. If you step into the kitchen to the left.
We'll come back to the fact that there are caves that you built into this in a second.
But yeah, it's kind of a problem. Yeah.
And when foodies have too much land.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So we, on the left, if you step to the left, you've got ciders. You step to the right, there was sauerkrauts. And mostly we never got in each other's way. I got a bad infestation from her side once, a lactobacillus. I got some stringy stuff going on in my ciders. Mm-hmm. But I got her back one time because I had all my apples in there sweating. Mm-hmm. Before we did it, and some of the enzymes somehow got into the fermentation cave. And we had 10 gallons of leek. What was it? Leek pepper?
It was just lemon dill kraut.
Lemon dill?
Basic kraut.
And I'm getting ready to jar 10 gallons, and it's butter.
You know, it actually tasted pretty good. I mean, yeah. We didn't keep it because,
I think
what do you do with that? I mean, kraut butter's not a thing.
Right.
It can be.
I don't think it'll ever be a thing.
Something tells you this is not right. So occasionally we hardly ever cross over, but so the ciders are.
And what he's not telling you is I have to kind of go filch some of his cider vinegar.
Ah, yes. Well, that's fair.
Because, right? You have to have good alcohol to make good vinegar.
Absolutely.
This is as close as we get to marital strife. She wants a good cider to make vinegar, but it's like, we never negotiate ahead of time well enough. Because if the cider's really good, it's like, baby, we can't make that into vinegar. And she's like, we said 6 gallons goes to vinegar. It's like, I'm trying to renegotiate really badly.
Well, at least you're not accidentally letting it go to vinegar. At least you're doing it deliberately in most cases.
But
judging by that face.
That is correct.
Do you ever put hot peppers in your cider? You got some flavored ciders? You ever toy with that? And what apples have you grafted on your line?
We haven't done the peppers yet, but we're obviously going to do that this year. We grew a lot of hops on the south side of the house just to keep the house cool. And so we've done a lot of hops. Mm-hmm. It's Pacific Northwest, so hops goes in just about anything. But yeah, so we've done a lot of hop cider. And we're going to do chilies next.
So apples, we live about 3 hours away from a fellow who collected apples. He's in his early 90s now, and I kind of see it as an arc of apples up there. He's has 4,000 varieties from all over the world. So in about 2007, so a few years before we built the commercial kitchen, we went up there and we just hung out and walked these orchards with this guy, and it was awesome. And we found some really great varieties. Now there's a kind called a Red Streak, mm-hmm. and it was one of the premier cider apples, and it's questionable if this is the Red Streak of, what is it, the 16th century? But it is a Red Streak, and so it's supposed to be a wonderful cider apple. So we've got some of those. We've got a lot of russets, some nice crabs to get those tannins in.
Mm-hmm. And we've got two trees on the property that have came up since we were there. They make it's a yellow crab, but pretty good size. And just up the road is Apple Outlaw. It's a cidery. And so we sent some of those up there. They aged them for almost 2 years in oak barrels. And it's got that scrumpy thing going on, and it's 10% alcohol, and it is.
Was it a bourbon or whiskey barrels?
Whiskey barrels, yeah. And it is just the most to die for cider ever. So I'm protecting those trees. I mean, so they call them the Shocky Crabs.
Shocky Crabs, nice. I mean, Oregon is really cider friendly. There's over 80, 85, over, like, far beyond that now, probably. 2 years ago, there was just 80. 85 cideries.
Just 80.
Just 80, right. So pretty awesome that exists. So have you then fermented apples and peppers? And is there an apple and pepper fiery ferment?
That would be brilliant. No, that'll be this year.
To come. Okay. There you can finally find a place for cinnamon, maybe.
Cinnamon,
apple, pepper.
Did the quince.
Did it work?
I did try pears and that wasn't as yummy.
No?
Did pears, dried pears, and fresh pears with lots of chilies, and we ate it. Didn't make the recipe book.
Didn't make the recipe book. The recipe book named Fiery Ferments, and available where?
Everywhere.
Everywhere. Everywhere good books are sold. Kirsten Shockey and Christopher Shockey. And the website is?
Ferment.works.
Ferment.works. Thank you so much for joining us on Ferment About It.
It's been wonderful.
I'm excited about tonight's event, too. Tell us what you're doing tonight at tonight's event.
We are going to talk about making Haas, and we're going to demonstrate basically three different ways to get to pepper mash with fresh and dried peppers.
And we're going to do a lot of tasting because we carry those things with us everywhere we go. So,
and TSA loves us.
I have an arrows everywhere.
We're delighted and excited to host it. Cheers and ferment about it. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
For listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat & 3.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.